We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Baseball is back, basketball is heating up, and the NFL draft is right around the corner. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app, the biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Welcome to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personality shaping the stories. Special Edition is a production of Entercom Communications.
Welcome to Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan. June is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Dr. Gad Marshall will be with us to tell us about a new trial for Alzheimer's research and treatment. We're also going to get a wrap-up from Dr. Jaewon Ryu, President and CEO of Geisinger, on the pandemic situation. You may have been seeing the announcements on local TV stations, and the chair of the FCC Incentive Auction Task Force is here to tell us why scanning your TV is going to be important. The fight against illegal drugs continues. The U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania will be here to give us the latest update on some arrests that happened this week. And we'll also hear from the mayor of Pittston, moving into another phase for reopening and what that is going to mean. But first, it was a busy day on Tuesday, primary election day. Scott Seaborg, the Pennsylvania director of All Voting is Local, takes a look at what the primary was like.
We know that voters had to face a lot of hurdles at every turn to the ballot this primary election. We had a pandemic that, you know, while is looking better in some counties, and we also had sort of a generational uprising in protests. And, you know, those were two things that combined to, I think, make it slightly more challenging to get to the polls. We know that it's laudable that Pennsylvania processed almost 2 million mail-in ballot applications. And we also know that it's the responsibility of our election officials to ensure measures are in place to enable voters to safely cast their ballots. And so, you know, we had a real success with the volume of vote-by-mail ballots that were processed by the state. And I think that folks on the ground, especially those who chose to vote in person, faced some hurdles.
Were you hearing any difficulties as far as people getting into the polls, any problem with the polls? Because, again, one of the other things was new voting machines in 22 counties, including in our area in Luzerne County.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that we experienced sort of the normal road bumps or speed bumps as it relates to, you know, polls being open in a lot of counties. And one thing that really, I think, affected folks' ability to find their polling place were the polling place consolidations. I know that in places like Philadelphia and Allegheny County, there were lots and lots of voters sort of collapsed into larger precincts that are combined from the smaller ones. And that made for some confusion, right? And I think we can acknowledge the challenges that counties and the state are facing right now with the pandemic, and also sort of be, confident and stern about the fact that we need more polling places, better plan to communicate that out with the public, and more advance knowledge of when those changes are going to happen as we approach the general election.
And as we are going to be approaching the general election, again, here in Pennsylvania, the opportunity, whether you needed to or not, have a mail-in ballot. Do you, as far as what you've been hearing from, you know, the different people that you talk to, again, across the state, do you think that it was well received? Do you think that have you been hearing that maybe when November comes around, there's going to be more people who are going to decide that mail-in balloting is okay?
I think the thing that we're all sort of, you know, really surprised by is just the sheer volume. I mean, we're almost at 20 times the volume of the general election in 2016 from vote by mail. And, you know, if that's any indication, then, you know, we think it's prudent for counties in the state to really prepare for a much higher volume in the general election, right? We know Pennsylvania has been voting safely and securely with absentee ballots for years and years. And now that the program has been expanded, folks are able to, you know, really utilize that tool. One thing that we definitely want to see is the vote by mail online application translated into Spanish for folks who have limited English proficiency. And at the same time, we'd like the online application to allow for using the last four digits of your Social Security number in addition to your Pennsylvania ID. Either one we think should be able to work. And that's really going to allow you know, everybody who's an eligible voter in Pennsylvania to utilize the tool.
Talk about baptism by fire with this primary election.
Absolutely.
With so many different, you just thought you had one, and then all of a sudden something else came along, and then a third, and then a fourth. So what does All Voting is Local Pennsylvania looking forward to now as you go forward to November? You did mention some of the things that, you know, may be able to help, but now that all these, you know, prepare for a fifth, I guess, if anything happens toward November, what will your organization be focusing on?
Well, I think one thing was painfully clear in terms of the vote by mail tool. Communities of color don't have a legacy of using vote by mail in Pennsylvania, just like lots of other communities, right? This is a new thing. And we're looking at early data, and it's indicating that there needs to be more outreach to communities of color in Pennsylvania to talk about vote by mail and why it's a safe option and why it's a way to make your, or how it's a way to make your voice heard while, you know, making sure that your ballot is secure. And so we'll be looking to do that education as well as looking to, you know, call on officials in the state to do certain things around vote by mail balloting. One is provide a prepaid postage return envelope with that vote by mail ballot. I think a lot of young folks aren't even sure what a stamp is these days, and that is definitely a barrier, right? And so, you know, we're going to be taking a look at the primary as a test run for the general, identifying areas that were trouble spots and growth areas, and then, you know, really working with the community in Pennsylvania to make sure that we're in the best possible place we can heading into the general election.
The other thing, too, is the poll workers themselves. Obviously, in this election, there were a lot who decided on their own that they were not going to be able to participate because of the ongoing pandemic. So is there also going to be a push in order to get, again, more young people involved? Because eventually that is going to just make its way out where the people that have been working the polls for so many years are not going to be able to be there. And that in itself may cause another problem when you're thinking about people that are going to be able to go and vote who still want to go and vote in person.
Yeah, I hear you. And I think, you know, that is a challenge facing election officials at all levels throughout the nation right now. You know, one thing that we believe is important is that, you know, if folks really feel a calling to sort of help with their community's sort of civic duty, then we think it's a great idea to, you know, consider working as a poll worker. I know that some of the wages in counties have been raised as an incentive. And we also think it's really important to understand the county or the entity's sort of PPE and COVID practices, and, you know, really ensure that as anyone is engaging in this work, that they're keeping themselves safe, that they're keeping their families safe, while also, you know, really helping to lead Pennsylvania down the road to a successful election.
Did you hear anything about that as far as people who were choosing to vote in person, whether there were any concerns about safety at polling places, whether people were not social distancing, whether I know there were late ads that I heard different places that said, bring your own writing utensil, bring your own, bring it home with you, or, you know, drop it off. So all of those things just seemed to go along, again, not as though it was being made up as it went along, but it was another, uh-oh, we have to think about this now. We have to think about that.
We do know that the state furnished each county, and in turn, each county furnished each polling location with PPE gear. And, you know, we definitely think that's a great thing. There were a few instances of, you know, folks reporting that there were a lack of masks or gloves in polling places, and for the most part, that PPE gear was there in place. We also know that in a few locations, there were some issues with social distancing at the lines, and, you know, that didn't really come in as a huge red flag. There were some instances of that, and I think that's something that it'll be important to work with election officials on to ensure there are blanket standards and that everyone is following the really important social distancing and PPE guidelines.
And since we now have November to look forward to, I'm hoping that we will catch up with you several times again between now and then. Can you give our listeners just a quick overview of what the All Voting is Local, of which you are the Pennsylvania State Director, what your group is all about, and how they might be able to reach out to you?
Absolutely. So All Voting is Local Pennsylvania fights to eliminate needless and discriminatory barriers to voting before they happen in an effort to build a democracy that works for everybody. You can definitely reach out to us on Twitter at All Voting is Local and allvotingislocal.org. We'd love to hear from you and connect with you and your community. And we really, really appreciate the time today. Thank you so much.
Oh, absolutely. Do you have any kind of a local presence here in northeastern Pennsylvania?
You know, our staff are located in Allegheny County as well as in Philadelphia, and we are interested in building some outreach in that area. And so I think you can expect some vote by mail outreach as well as collaboration with partners that are already in the area.
Awesome. Well, when you decide that you're coming up this way, you definitely let us know, and we'll have the welcome mat out for you.
Will do. Thank you so much.
While you've been watching TV, you may have seen some announcements from some local stations about having to rescan your TV if you use an antenna. Gene Cadeau is the chair of the FCC Incentive Auction Task Force and tells us why.
One of the things that we do at the FCC is make sure that we use the nation's airwaves as efficiently as we can. And we've identified the TV spectrum that TV stations use to broadcast their signals as an area we could use more efficiently and therefore free up some spectrum for wireless carriers. American consumers have ever-increasing demand for faster and faster speeds and more capacity for their wireless devices. So we're rearranging some TV stations across the country to use less airwaves and more efficiently and free up space for wireless carriers. So what that means is that if a viewer watches TV using an antenna, meaning a rooftop or an indoor antenna, as opposed to cable or satellite subscription to get their local TV, they'll need to rescan their TVs each time this happens so that their TV knows where to find the channels at their new place in the airwaves.
When you talk about something like this happening, are there any possibilities that people are going to lose their channels?
There should not be. No, what we made sure we did when we reassigned frequencies to stations, we made sure that the new frequencies would allow them to broadcast to the same coverage area and the same population that they had before. Now, while the change is happening, sometimes there's a brief period of time when a station goes on to an interim antenna while they put their new antenna up on their tower, that there may be some decrease in the coverage, but ultimately it should be the same.
So it should be a seamless proposition from beginning to end.
Right, and viewers just need to know that they need to rescan their TVs when this happens to find the channels.
Now, when you say rescan, what exactly does that mean?
Well, when a viewer sets up a TV to use an antenna for the first time, they need to scan the TV to find all of the available local channels. What that means is they basically just go into the menu function on the remote control and scan the TV, and they had to do that when they set it up. And a rescan is exactly what it sounds like, which is to redo that process so the TV can go out and find a local channel at its new home. The channel numbers that viewers see are not changing. So if a viewer is used to watching, say, channel 22, it will still be channel 22, but the TV needs to be trained to find channel 22 at its new home in the air.
Ah, okay. So it's more or less for the TV's benefit rather than the viewer's benefit of the change in the channel.
Right. We want to make this as seamless for viewers as possible. So stations really do want to continue to use the same channel numbers, so viewers who are used to tuning to channel 22 or 64 or whatever they're used to, they'll continue to do. It's just that the TV needs to be retrained.
And then how would someone know that this is either happening or has already happened, that they would have to go and do this? Is there a way?
Yes, so there's a couple different ways. The TV stations who are affected have to give notice to their viewers at least 30 days in advance, so there'll be public service announcements and on-screen text messages and other things that they use to make sure their viewers are aware of the change and what the date will be on which they'll make it. We also have information on our FCC website, which is www.fcc.gov/TV rescan, and there's a map. A viewer can put his or her zip code in and see which stations are locally available and whether any of them are making the change and the time frame. And then just generally a good rule of thumb is if a viewer has an over-the-air antenna TV and notices that a channel that they're used to seeing seems to have gone missing, they should probably rescan, and hopefully that is what happened, and that'll bring the channel back.
But traditionally, you would only have to rescan once, correct?
Well, it's always a good idea. It's sort of like rebooting a computer.
It's
probably a good idea to do it once in a while. If a viewer hasn't done it in a couple of years, since they set up the TV the first time, they may find that there are actually more channels available locally for free than they knew they had, because what the TV will do when it goes out in the air and scans, it goes through the whole range of possible channels. And local stations are bringing on what we call sub-channels or multicast channels all the time. And those are those, if you watch over-the-air TV, you're used to seeing maybe channel 22.1 and .2 and .3. Well, those .2 and .3 channels are new streams of programming that TV stations are putting out. So it may be a happy circumstance to rescan so the viewers can see that there are actually many more stations available than they thought.
And I was just going to say that. Is it possible that when they do rescan, they find out that, gee, I was wondering what happened to that one? So is this something that maybe people should do just on a normal basis instead of just accepting the fact that their TV is telling them everything that they think that it should be?
Right. The TV is only telling them what it found the last time it rescanned. So if a viewer rescans every couple of months or every year or so, they may find that new stations have come on that the TV doesn't know about.
Ah, well, that's a surprise.
Yeah.
A pleasant surprise, usually.
Well, and the good news is these are all for free, right? You don't have to subscribe to them. These are all available over the air. So, yes, it's a good thing to do.
That's right. Now, when are these changes coming into effect?
Well, they're happening at different times. We're doing it in a 10-phase process. A couple of stations in Wilkes-Barre, Scranton have already gone, so viewers may have rescanned already, and if not, they may find that those channels will come back when they scan this time. And then there's, I think, one station that's going to be changing in this current phase, which is this week, and then two more that will be changing in the next couple of months. So viewers should be on the lookout for those notices, and if they notice a channel they're used to seeing goes missing, try rescanning.
Jean, if you can give us once again the information on where people can get more information, that would be great.
Right. Our website is www.fcc.gov/TV rescan. And we've also set up a call center with a help desk for folks who may need a little extra help in rescanning and how to do it. They may have forgotten how they did it when they set up their TV. And the number there is 1-888-CALL-FCC, which is 1-888-225-5322, option number 6. And it's available 7 days a week, from 8 a.m. to 1 a.m. Eastern Time in English and Spanish. So if a viewer notices a channel's missing in the evening or on the weekend, they can call that number if they need some help.
So they should call you, not the place where they bought the TV.
Correct. They should call the call center and get help. Now, if they try rescanning and there's a problem, they might want to call their station and see if the station's having any issues. But other than that, the call center should be able to help them with the rescan process. And hopefully, 99% of the time, it brings the channel back.
Excellent. Thank you so much. We appreciate the information.
Well, and I appreciate your helping to get the word out to your listeners, because we want to make sure that they continue to get all their channels and maybe more.
Thanks, Jean. And of course, you can always check the websites of your favorite local stations and find out when that is happening. Don't go away when Special Edition returns. The fight to get illegal drugs off the streets continues, and one municipality is getting ready to start another phase of reopening. Don't go away. Welcome back to Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan. Thanks for joining us today. More are heading back to opening up. That includes the city of Pittston. Pittston Mayor Michael Lombardo joined Intercom's Doc and Jesse to find out what's in store now that they're getting the signal that they can begin.
All right, so last week in Luzerne County, and hopefully this week in Lackawanna County, it's going to flip over to yellow. And we have the mayor of Pittston, Michael Lombardo, who's on with us right now. So, Mayor, what does that mean?
Well, I think it means that we can start to eke our way back to sort of a more normal, start opening up some things, I think, give some people an opportunity, particularly as it relates to recreation, to get outside a little bit more. We can really look at our schedule now in terms of some of the upcoming events, and I think make adjustments that, you know, we can handle them and pull them off in a way that's safe and compliant with what the regulations are at this point.
What about things like restaurants? I saw that Tomato Bar is reopening on Friday. Will there be a limit to how many people can go to a restaurant? How do things like that work?
Yeah, so what you got to do, essentially, I mean, in the restaurant situation, you'd be looking at outside venues. Restaurants are still not allowed to do internal seating. So you'd be looking at sidewalk seating. In the case of the Tomato Bar and places like the Red Mill, they have outdoor venues already that are part of their facility. So when they use those, obviously, they can't use them at maximum capacity. They need to use them in a manner that allows them to have people to come and dine and distance at a safe way. And then, of course, and obviously, their staff will need to take the necessary precautions. Certainly the outside, according to the data and research, is safer and better than indoors. Actually, interesting, we're working on this thing we started last fall called the Portable Patio, and it's actually a conversion of an old trailer that we've been converting it into essentially a moving deck, and it could be utilized in front of a restaurant that doesn't have enough sidewalk space to accommodate probably up to 6 or 7 tables with the right distance.
Do you think most businesses will be back open?
I feel really confident. We've been communicating all along with businesses. We right now are doing a crowdfunding initiative called Progress Through Partnership, and we are almost halfway to our goal of $30,000. We're going to take that money and we're going to actually leverage that against some community development money we have, and we'll be able to backfill a little bit and help, you know, alleviate some of the financial pain that's been caused. And I think we'll be able to help quickly get those businesses back up on their feet. A lot of times we get credit for all this revitalization that's occurring, but the truth is we're lucky to have a tight community. And it's not only us. I think you'll see that all through northeastern PA. And this personally is why I love this place.
You know, when I first moved here, seeing what downtown Pittston was and what it is today is night and day.
I think the message at the end of the day is that it's about the idea of working together. Not one person can do it. We do some fun things. I'm looking forward to getting back out and getting some events going. We have some new things that we're going to roll out over the next couple months. We've kind of used this quiet time to regroup a little bit.
Can you share any of those with us, or is that all top secret?
You know, I've got people, so if you tell too many people, you know, I'll just send them your way.
You could tell her, but you'd have to kill her, right, Michael?
Exactly. No, I mean, we're talking about some partnerships. We've been having this conversation with Kings about rowing down on the riverfront. I can tell you that over the next couple months, I will be announcing securing another institution of higher education to have a satellite operation downtown. And we're creating this thing called the Pittston Art Academy. We have two really cool new housing things that we'll be rolling out, and both of them have some partial funding in place. We're working on a big jazz and blues festival. We've actually put a elevator in the fire station. That's important because it gets us to the third floor and the public can use that. There's a really cool basketball court up there that we're going to use as an indoor venue.
Wow, you got a lot going on.
Yeah, I'm really excited. I'm encouraged. Hats off to everybody that's worked hard. Again, without partners, you can't move forward.
Mayor Michael Lombardo, City of Pittston, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Oh, thank you both very much. I appreciate it. Stay safe, everybody, and healthy. We're getting there.
And the city of Pittston also got some other good news earlier this week. A just over $700,000 community development block grant funding came through the Department of Community and Economic Development. It will be used for the Panama Street Reconstruction Project in the city of Pittston. U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania David Freed has been a guest here on Special Edition in the past to bring us updates of different programs that are being utilized throughout the state in order to get drugs off the streets. That includes Project Safe Neighborhoods. Earlier this week, an announcement was made that 11 people now face federal indictments for a drug trafficking ring that was operating primarily in Luzerne County. U.S. Attorney Freed joined Intercom's Frank Andrews to give us the details.
You know, over the past few weeks, we have been so preoccupied with COVID-19 that we forgot to think about all the illegal drugs and all the problems that were going on. People addicted, people dying out there. And so while we didn't pay attention to that, that didn't mean that law enforcement was not. And on the line with us right now is U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Pennsylvania, David Freed, to talk about this arrest. Thank you very much for joining us, sir, and tell us about this arrest, sir.
Thanks, Frank. Thanks for having me back on. So today we announced the indictment and arrest of 11 individuals in a drug ring based in Wilkes-Barre. You know, source of supply, as sort of usual in our cases up there, is the New York and New Jersey area. But we believe this takedown will put a pretty big dent in what's going on there in the city of Wilkes-Barre in particular, and elsewhere throughout Northeast PA. We indicted 11 people last week, did an operation yesterday to do the arrest. There's still one outstanding, but he knows he's wanted and is in contact with law enforcement. Also executed some search warrants, took some more drugs off the streets, took some cars, took some guns, and an additional search warrant down in North Carolina where we got some cash and some guns as well.
Now, this was a bunch of different law enforcement agencies working together, and from what I saw in the news release, it was over a year-long investigation?
Yeah, so what happened with this one was things really came together well. Started out actually with a drug delivery resulting in death case out of Wyoming County, and DA Jeff Mitchell and his staff asked us to get involved at the federal level. We prosecuted that case and got a conviction on a guy about a year ago, and in doing our intel from that case, developed the initials of a dealer who was one of the initial suppliers of the drugs in that case, and then turned that into probable cause for a bunch of wiretaps, got a bunch of calls and text messages, and then, you know, sort of traditional police work, and spun it up into charging these 11 folks with significant amounts of drugs. They're looking at significant jail time too, and I'm really proud of the collaboration. FBI, State Police, Attorney General, Pittston, Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, Plymouth, just about, and Wilkes-Barre City, of course.
What kind of drugs did you take off the street?
So heroin in the search warrants yesterday was pretty much what they had on hand. The indictment alleges sale of a relatively small amount of crack cocaine, much larger amounts of heroin and fentanyl. You know, it really depends in our area, Frank, on what's coming in. So the supply they happen to have now was heroin, but it's been a lot of heroin and fentanyl over the last year or so.
That's unbelievable. David, I have to ask you, because, you know, you were the one 2 years ago that really piqued our interest to do a program on law enforcement appreciation. We did it again this year. And I'm you know, not only am I crushed and saddened by the murder of George Floyd, but also the rogue police officers and the damage they do to all of the good law-abiding, ethical police officers that are out there fighting for us.
Yeah, Frank, we're at a tough moment here, no matter where you are in the U.S. And you know, like with a lot of things, we're not impacted as badly here in the Middle District. You know, our protests and demonstrations have been largely peaceful, and I'm very pleased and proud of everybody for doing that. But the first thing I said today when I stood up in that press conference was that I'm here to stand, and you've heard me say it before, on behalf of law-abiding citizens. And that means law-abiding police, and the vast, vast majority of our police are great people who want to stand up for law-abiding citizens and the protesters. And I sent a message to them saying, listen, I understand that you might not trust us. I understand that you might not want to hear what we're saying, but I want you to hear what I'm saying. And that's, we're standing up for you and your lawful right to protest. There's nothing more American than that. Now, if we start causing damage and assaults and attacking police officers, we're going to have to get involved. But I want everybody to understand that our first and foremost duty is to stand up for law-abiding citizens. You know, I said it today, it's a great saying, everybody counts or nobody counts. And I want everybody out there who's expressing themselves to know that they count, and we're going to stand up for them too.
Well, I said on the air, I said, you know, one of the first groups that would condemn what happened to Mr. Floyd would be the law-abiding, ethical police officers, the law enforcement officials who would condemn that kind of action.
Well, 100%, Frank. I mean, if anybody, you know, anybody in my position who's dealt with police use of force issues knows that there are huge problems in what went on in Minneapolis. And it's just devastating. I was talking to the chief in Wilkes-Barre today, you know, about how he's handling, you know, his younger officers who are coming in to this profession at a time when law enforcement is constantly under attack. And I think it's very important for, you know, the law-abiding citizens out there, people just going about their daily lives, who can be really quiet sometimes, to maybe step up and say, hey, we support you. Let me tell you this great story. I was leaving today. I was in Wilkes-Barre for the press conference and heading back to Harrisburg, and was going out the door of the police department, and there was a woman and her son, probably, you know, 12 or 13 years old, standing out there in the rain. I opened the door for them, and they looked confused. And I said, can I help you? And they said, and they showed me what they had. They had a couple boxes of cookies. And they said, we're just here to drop this off to show support for our law enforcement officers. And I was just moved by that. You know, I sent them in to the department, and I'm sure it was well most appreciated by the men and women of Wilkes-Barre. I just thought that was a wonderful thing, and that really made my day.
And I appreciate your work, and I appreciate you calling us and giving us an update on what you called this group peddling poison. Thanks for clearing that up for us, sir.
Thanks for the opportunity, Frank.
Now don't go away. We'll be hearing from members of the medical community next on Special Edition. We'll hear from Dr. Rue at Geisinger, and June is Alzheimer's Awareness Month. Dr. Gad Marshall will join us about a study that's ongoing, and you can take part. Don't go away. Next on Special Edition, Dr. Gad Marshall of Bingham and Women's Hospital with an online study to help track Alzheimer's.
Well, so Alzheimer's disease is unfortunately an epidemic. I know we're dealing with a different pandemic with COVID-19, but Alzheimer's disease has been an epidemic across the world, in the U.S., as well as in our local state of Pennsylvania for many years now. What we see is as you age, there is a certain segment of the population that's at greater risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. There are changes in the brain that we can track. There are clinical symptoms such as memory decline, language difficulties, sense of direction difficulties, changes in mood and behavior, and ultimately decline in your daily functioning that progresses with time. This is an irreversible, continuous neurodegenerative disease. And in recent years, we focused on early detection of Alzheimer's disease. And this will give me the opportunity to discuss a new web study that we launched about a year ago.
When you talk about early detection, that must be something that's very difficult because it can mimic so many other disorders that people 65 and older are dealing with.
Absolutely. So when you age, you can have changes in your memory and thinking abilities for many reasons, including just getting older. Trying to separate that type of change from a disease like Alzheimer's disease is important in terms of whether or not we should be concerned about more aggressive decline down the road and what we can do about it. And so what we're offering today is a web study called APT or APT Web Study, found on aptwebstudy.org, which is a national effort funded by the NIH to detect the earliest symptoms of Alzheimer's disease with a simple computerized assessment you can take from the comfort of your home. All you need is a computer or a tablet connected to the internet. We're looking for individuals age 50 or older who do not have significant symptoms yet. And so we can track you over time with a 20-minute type of memory test every 3 months and let you know if, in fact, you are declining, and if so, what you can do about it, either in a clinical setting or in another research setting, such as a prevention trial for Alzheimer's disease.
Again, it can mimic so many other things. Are there what you would consider classic Alzheimer's symptoms?
Yeah. So Alzheimer's disease, as you said, classically would present as a consistent decline in your short-term memory, also some language changes early on, such as word-finding difficulties, changes in your sense of direction, and also changes in your mood early on, such as mild depressive symptoms, anxiety, lack of motivation, irritability. Early on, we usually don't see decline in daily functioning. That is something that we see usually when you hit the stage of dementia. The key is that there's a change from your prior abilities and that it is a consistent change, not just one day that something happens and then you're back to normal.
And as far as the study is concerned, then, you're looking for people at the age of 50?
Yeah, so we're looking for people who are much younger than the typical onset of Alzheimer's disease. So the typical onset in the U.S. is early 70s for the stage of dementia. For milder memory symptoms, it will be late 60s. We're looking for people who are, way younger than that in terms of potentially having a risk that's biological or genetic risk in their family. And we're looking for the very earliest changes in their memory performance that they might not be aware of, that we can detect with these sensitive computer tests over time. And then if we do detect a change, we could recommend that either if it's a significant change, they seek clinical care or they participate in a research study to have more assessments with scans of their brain, say, or in fact participate in a trial where we're testing a new drug to prevent Alzheimer's disease in people who do not have significant symptoms yet, but may be at risk.
That's another interesting question, because there is really no cure for Alzheimer's, and there are drugs now that are going to start to be investigated, well, cure it, or would that just slow it down?
there is no cure. The treatments that we have available currently are used at the stage of dementia only, not prior to that, to mildly boost your symptoms, improve them for 6 or 12 months, and then they wear off. What we're looking for is medications or interventions that will at least slow the decline over time, and of course preferably stop it altogether, which would be a cure. That, you know, we will settle for significantly slowing the decline. If you do that for several years, you can really change the quality of life of older adults. And so that's what we're looking for. And you know, we've been doing these type of clinical trials for years, and we've been moving to earlier stages in hopes of having more success.
When you also mentioned genetics in there, if a person has had a family member, are you able to tell by the study that you're starting, the APT study, that there might be a predisposition, or maybe there's not a predisposition? Is it more possible that there could be something environmental?
Well, so we try and take into account several of these factors. This particular study is pretty streamlined, so we can't be exhaustive, and all of it is based on answering questions online. And so we're not doing any blood tests or scans of your brain with this particular study, but we try and get demographic information and family history information, and also some medical history in order to figure out some of your risk factors. And yes, you could have a family history or genetic risk factor. You could have a risk factor from various common medical conditions like elevated blood pressure or cholesterol, diabetes, and in fact, from stressors from the environment or your life generally. Say you're a caregiver, you can be stressed from that. Say you have you know, mood disorder, that could be a stressor. Your diet and exercise can beneficially or detrimentally affect your risk. And so these are various things we look at as well.
Dr. Marshall, this is fascinating. And again, the Alzheimer's prevention trials, how can people get involved? Where can they find the information?
Well, so it's very simple. You just log on to our website, aptwebstudy.org. You learn about the study, and then if you're interested, you can sign up right there and then and get started.
Dr. Marshall, thank you so much, and hopefully in the future you'll be able to come back and we'll talk about what you've been finding out as far as the trials are concerned.
Thank you for your time and for the opportunity.
Intercom's Rocky and Lissa caught up with Dr. Rue from Geisinger.
Our current situation, Dr. Rue, is that on Friday, a lot of restaurants are opening for outdoor seating. So what is your advice for servers, masking, distancing, everything?
I think this all gets to what the new normal will look like, and I put the word normal in quotes because I'm not sure there is such a thing as normal, but I do think as we get into this next phase, as things start to reopen, it's more important now than ever before to keep maintaining that distancing and masking effort. And so I see a lot of restaurants getting really creative. Outdoor is obviously a lot better than indoor, and so I know that that's not possible at each and every restaurant, but for the places that are able to accommodate outdoor dining, I think that's a good way to go. Obviously, indoor or outdoor, you still want to maintain the distance. And so, you know, maybe it's fewer people in the restaurant at the same time. Maybe it's just rearranging how you have the flow and the tables and so forth. And then, of course, with the servers and others working in the environment, as well as the patrons themselves, I think masking is always the right way to go. Obviously, you have to take off the mask to eat and drink and so forth, but for other times, it's good to have that mask on. Those combination of different interventions will really help to mitigate and manage that risk.
Now, Doctor, what's your take on traveling? I kind of get skeeved out at staying at hotels to begin with, but are you willing to stay at a hotel? Because I'm just thinking about everything we touch in a hotel before COVID-19, the remote control, coffee pot, and all the doorknobs. How comfortable are you to stay at a hotel or a motel?
Yeah, I think this question comes up a lot, and I think it's ultimately, not to give you a cop-out answer, but I think it depends, and it's ultimately a balancing of, obviously, you're always weighing the risks with the benefits, and one of the benefits is how essential is the travel, and to the extent that it's essential, obviously, then you shift into the mode of how do you mitigate and minimize those risks. And I do think there are ways to do that, whether it's a hotel or other places. Obviously, you have to still be mindful of the same concepts of masking and distancing and so forth. But I think it means when you get into the room, you do a proper wipe down with the right kind of antibacterial kinds of bleach-based products or alcohol-based products that we've been recommending all along. And it's in those high-touch environments, whether the faucets, the handles, I mean, you mentioned a lot of them. I think that's exactly where I would go with that. And then maybe even doing some things like opening the windows to circulate the air before you head into the room. So I would do those things and maybe leave for an hour or so, let the air kind of circulate again, if those things are feasible, and then re-enter. I think those are probably the best ways to minimize the exposure. And then, of course, frequent washing of hands, disinfecting of other surfaces. I think those all play as well. But at the end of the day, you have to make a decision, each person, how essential is the travel, and do you want to balance those benefits against the risks that would come with it?
Rocky was already the dude who brought Lysol wipes to a hotel room, even before all of this. So this isn't helping.
I try not to think about it.
Yeah. Well, I'll be honest with you. I mean, even during flu season, even apart from COVID, that's probably not a bad practice.
And the next question I have for you, Dr. Rue, comes courtesy of my niece and nephew, Ben and Amy. They're still in online school right now, but pretty soon they're going to be done. And they're already bugging mom and dad to go out to play with their friends, to do baseball, et cetera. So, and their folks are hesitant. So what advice would you have for parents? I mean, their kids want to go out and play.
I think this is another one where it's a balancing, and it's a balancing of the risks and the benefits. And obviously people have been cooped up for quite some time, and especially with children, I know that can be difficult to keep them engaged and occupied. And we have school-age children ourselves, so this is always a discussion for us as well. I think it's the same balancing act of what are the risks, what are the benefits, and are there ways to mitigate the risks? And I would say the ways to mitigate the risks are to try to steer towards outdoor activities versus indoor. Indoor for prolonged periods of time, in close proximity, we know that those things carry higher risk. And so if they're able to be outside, I think still masked is ideal. And obviously, however you can maintain distance, that would be good. I know that's a challenge sometimes with kids and play environments. But if there's a way to maintain some distancing and ensure that they're masked and in an outdoor environment, then I think you're doing pretty well as far as keeping those risks to a minimum.
Good deal.
And one final question, out-of-town visitors. I'm trying to get my sister and her boyfriend to visit. They live in Manhattan, so, of course, they're still having a big issue there. If they don't show any symptoms for a couple of weeks, they're good to go, or should they be tested before they come visit? We keep going back and forth on this.
Yeah, I think this is trickier, and it's because there's always the risk of asymptomatic transfer, meaning people could have the infection, could be contagious, and yet not show symptoms. That risk is lower, but that is still out there, and that's the nature of community spread, which is the phenomenon where the virus can be spread inside the community, and we know that that's true. And so I would start with the same decision-making process of how necessary is the interaction, balancing the risks against the benefits. Testing is tricky as well because that's just a single snapshot in time, and are they at the right course, assuming they have the virus, are they at the right time period in that course to have tested positive? And given that it's only a single snapshot, you know, will they subsequently become positive? I think those are all things that are very difficult to determine in a definitive way. Ways to limit the risk is, again, encouraging masking even inside the home in that regard. And I think the safest is probably a quarantine, and that's how a lot of areas or even countries are doing it, is if you're a visitor from somewhere else, you're quarantined for 2 weeks to make sure you're not symptomatic, reduces that risk considerably. And so I think it's a combination of those factors, but if the visit is absolutely necessary, then I think you'd ideally still want to be mindful of not sharing food, not sharing cups, ideally a separate bathroom, masking and distancing even in that home environment. And if it's feasible to have a 2 week quarantine period, which I know oftentimes is difficult logistically, I think that's going to be the right answer there.
I love my sister, but 2 weeks will drive each other crazy.
Yeah. But you want to keep loving your family, in which case the 2 weeks may not be the right way to go.
I appreciate the advice, though. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ru, so much. You are wonderful. Hopefully we get to chat again soon.
Yeah, I hope so, too. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personalities shaping the stories. A production of Intercom Communications.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.